Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm James Hattori in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The stunning recent national intelligence estimate stating that Iran had halted its nuclear weapons program in 2003 was seen by many in Washington as a brushback pitch aimed at White House hawks. By any measure, it was extraordinary. America having a very public debate over its most sensitive intelligence. Its effect on U.S. foreign policy toward Iran is unclear, and it raises big questions about how, and why such judgments are made and made public. This hour on Point, the politics of intelligence. Joining me now from New York is Tim Weiner, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter from the New York Times. He's covered the intelligence community for two decades. His new book, Legacy of Ashes, The History of the CIA, won a National Book Award just last month. Tim, welcome back to On Point, and congratulations, by the way.
Thank you, James.
Tim, the fallout surrounding the national intelligence estimate continues. I mean, just over the weekend, Iran's President Ahmadinejad called it a declaration of surrender by the U.S. In Israel, criticism of the report is so vocal that Prime Minister Olmert told his cabinet to tone down that criticism. And just today, Russia is making headlines announcing that it has delivered the first shipment of nuclear fuel to Iran's atomic power station. But of that, of course, heightens worries that it will be used potentially down the road for military purposes. So let's start with what the NIE report said. What was its conclusion, and why was it such a huge deal?
All right. Let's start with what it said, and then let's put what it said in context, because it's very easy to take these unclassified judgments and twist them for political purposes. What it said was that the American intelligence community, this is 16 different agencies now, and this is the National Intelligence Council bringing them all to the table. We assess that until the fall of 2003, Iranian military entities were working under government direction to develop nuclear weapons, full stop. We judge with high confidence that that program halted in the fall of 2003 and is probably still halted. We don't know whether it has restarted. We don't know whether Iran intends to develop nuclear weapons in the future. We are pretty sure that Iran does not currently have a nuke, and we collectively think that Iran as a nation is not hell-bent on producing a nuclear bomb, no matter what the international political costs. That's what it says. Now, the degree of confidence the American intelligence community has in itself and the degree of confidence Americans have in our intelligence community are two very different things.
The assertion that the program has been stopped in Iran is a little muddled as well, because didn't it specifically refer to warhead development and while other activities are still continuing?
Here's what it boils down to. In the spring of 2005, American intelligence and the CIA were pretty sure that Iran was full tilt ahead building a bomb. Now they say, no, you know what? They stopped that in the fall of 2003. And we're not sure that they haven't restarted, but we don't think they have. And this head-spinning reversal is clearly based not on surmise, politics, guesswork, but actual intelligence emanating from the region and probably from inside Iran itself.
So what about today's news that Russia has completed the first shipment of nuclear fuel to Iran, ostensibly for the power station, not military purposes? But this has still got to raise some red flags. And does this issuance of the report essentially amount to a green light for other countries to now come in and help Iran with the reactors?
No, I don't think it is a green light. And I think it's very interesting to note that the person in the international community who is saying the loudest what this report says for months back, i.e. Iran is not building a bomb, was Vladimir Putin. He's saying no way they're building a bomb. Now, he's an old intelligence officer, remember. He used to work for the KGB. How does he know that? Probably through Iran's contact with Russia through this civilian program, which gives Russia's intelligence services a peephole into the dark side or military side of the equation.
Let's get a little background on the National Intelligence Estimate. Who assembles this report? And if it's a secret, why make it public?
Well, they declassified it. All right, let's turn the clock back, shall we? In 2002, the CIA, George Tenet, the intelligence community issue a report, an estimate, as they're called, saying, you know what? Iraq is bristling with chemical and biological weapons. They're building a nuke. They are a danger to humanity. Colin Powell presents this so-called intelligence to the United Nations and the world in early 2003. We go to war. Nope, it was wrong, dead wrong, on almost all its points. As a consequence of this, a direct consequence, the United States has restructured its intelligence community. The CIA is no longer first among equals. There's a new Directorate of National Intelligence that under that directorate is the National Intelligence Council, which has been around in some form since the 70s, but is now strengthened. And the guy running that council is Tom Fingar, an intelligence analyst who used to run the State Department's small but very savvy intelligence branch. Now, in March of 2005, as a consequence of the Iraq debacle, a presidential commission issues a report saying, quote, across the board, the American intelligence community knows disturbingly little about the nuclear programs of many of the world's most dangerous actors. In some cases, it now knows less than it did 5 or 10 years ago. Scary.
Tim, let me add another voice right now to the conversation. Joining us now from McLean, Virginia is Flint Leverett, former senior director for Middle East Affairs at the National Security Council under George W. Bush. He also served as a Middle East analyst and advisor in the CIA and State Department. He's now director of the Geopolitics of Energy Initiative at the New America Foundation, and he's the author of Inheriting Syria, Bashar's Trial by Fire. Flint, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
What's your take on the NIE report? You think it was a good idea to release it?
In the end, I think it was a good idea to release it. This was such a hot-button issue in American foreign policy and even in American politics more generally. I think that the intelligence community had legitimate concerns that even if you kept it only in a classified version, this report was going to get leaked within about 2 hours of its dissemination. And because it was going to be leaked, because the basic judgments in the report were going to become a matter of public discourse, within a matter of hours of it being released, you know, I think it was actually prudent to put out an unclassified version, do your best to protect sources and methods in that unclassified version, and put that out in a way so that there's an authoritative presentation of the key judgments.
What do we know about why this was made public? Was it an attempt by the CIA to avoid politicization of its findings?
Well, my understanding is that there was actually some contention within the intelligence community about this question. The Director of National Intelligence, Admiral O'Connell, is on record as saying he doesn't favor the release of unclassified versions of NIEs or other sorts of intelligence reports. I think there was considerable pushback from within the community to go ahead and prepare an unclassified version. One of the original requesters of this estimate had been Congress, and Congress had expressed an interest in having an unclassified version, which gave those in the community that wanted that to happen some measure of political cover. And I think in the end, the White House understood that this was going to leak, and it was probably better to go ahead and let an unclassified version come out so that at the very least, no one could accuse them of trying to suppress the findings.
Tim Weiner, what's your assessment of how this was made public?
Well, as Flint correctly says, the intelligence chief, Mike McConnell, said, I'm not declassifying this estimate. and everybody knew it was coming down. But the reversal that it represents, not 180-degree reversal, but pretty close, if that had been kept classified at a time when the war drums were starting to pound on the Potomac about Iran, weren't they? The president said, used the phrase World War III to represent the threat he thought a nuclear-armed Iran represented. If you had tried to keep this suppressed, there would have been hell to pay when it came out, as it inevitably would.
This is On Point. I'm James Hattori in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the politics of intelligence and the game-changing National Intelligence Estimate, which was issued this month. We've been talking with Tim Weiner, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for The New York Times. His new book, Legacy of Ashes, The History of the CIA, won the National Book Award last month. He's in New York. And also in Washington, we have Flint Leverett, a former official with the CIA, State Department, and the National Security Council under President Bush. He's now a director at the New America Foundation. And I'd like to introduce another guest to round out our panel. Joining me from Prague in the Czech Republic is Ruhl Mark Gerecht, who is a former CIA Middle East analyst and a keen Iran watcher. He's now a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. He served as an advisor to the Iraq Study Group, and he's author of The Islamic Paradox, Shiite Clerics, Sunni Fundamentalists, and the Coming of Arab Democracy. Ruhl, welcome back to On Point.
Pleasure.
Before we pick up on the discussion, let me play a sound excerpt from President Bush on December 4th when he reacted to news of the new intelligence estimate, which said that Iran had halted its nuclear weapons program in 2003.
I think it is very important for the international community to recognize the fact that if Iran were to develop the knowledge that they could transfer to a clandestine program, it would create a danger for the world. And so I view this report as a warning signal that they had the program, they halted the program. And the reason why it's a warning signal is that they could restart it.
Ruhl, what are your thoughts about the intelligence estimate? Do you agree with the president that it still is a warning signal?
Well, I would go further than that. I mean, I'm not sure the NIE really relieves all that much of one's concerns about the Iranian nuclear weapons program. I mean, the vast bulk of that program was what was revealed by the Iranian opposition group, the Mujahideen-e-Khalq, at the end of 2002. That is the open, what became the open part of that program. It had been clandestine. They'd been hiding it. That is really the overwhelming bulk of the process to develop a nuclear weapon. Now, what may have happened, and I'm not fully confident that NIE explains to us that, in fact, it did halt in 2003 for a length of time, though I think 2003 makes sense because of the Iraq War, that they, in fact, would have halted at that time, and the concern that the Americans, in fact, could go after them next and that their program was leaky because an Iranian opposition group had just revealed, of course, part of it. I'm not convinced the NIE has fundamentally changed the game. I mean, if you believe that the nuclear weapons for Iran is a serious threat to America's national security, then the NIE really doesn't change that. And I don't think it actually changed it for our allies overseas. I mean, it is my impression that neither the French, the British, or the Israelis got to review the primary material behind that NIE. They should be allowed to do so, particularly for the French and the Israelis, who have long had an independent method in their own sources on Iran. I actually think the French have been far closer to the truth than have the Americans, and they tend to have a fairly pessimistic view of the timeline. They should allow to be able to look at this. And certainly if the administration has any hope that you're going to maintain a transatlantic alliance, a transatlantic front on this issue, because what the NIE may have done is actually destroy 4 years of American diplomacy. And that is why folks over at the Department of State weren't terribly happy about it. And we need to have everybody on board. Everybody needs to see the same information. And it is, by the way, a problem for the analysts. I've be willing to bet large quantities of money that the vast majority of analysts from the 16 different intelligence agencies, you know, never really saw the primary material. The vast majority of them can't handle it because it comes in a foreign language. So I certainly wouldn't want to state with any confidence that the NIE is correct, and I certainly would be willing to state with any confidence that the nuclear weapons program that the clerical regime has been running since the end of the 1980s represents still a significant threat to the United States.
There's been a lot of conjecture about why Iran might have stopped its program, if you indeed accept the premise that it has stopped its program. What's your take on the rationale behind why they might have stopped their weapons
well,
processing?
I mean, I think there are a variety of reasons. I mean, what's most worrisome about the NIE's key judgments is that, I mean, anyone who had any familiarity with the Iranian conversation in Tehran and Coleman and 2003, or just had just a smattering of an understanding of power politics in the Middle East that it might come to play, would have mentioned that the Iraq War, the American invasion of Iraq in 2003 in the spring, would have been possibly a reason for the Iranians to stop their program. What's disconcerting about the NIE and the key judgments is that it's not even mentioned as a possibility. In fact, they throw in the sort of out of nowhere this notion that a diplomacy must assume the EU3 diplomacy, since that was the only diplomacy going on, somehow spooked the Iranians. But that makes no sense really whatsoever, because of November of 2003, Ali Khamenei, the leader of the country, basically tells the Europeans to go stick it on their approach, and that has essentially been the Iranian attitude ever since then. I mean, it's very difficult to say with any confidence that the day before this NIE release that the Iranians looked upon the EU3 diplomacy as being all that intimidating. I think there were signs inside of the country that they were beginning to get a little worried. But for them to have stopped what had been their Manhattan Project because of concerns about the European Union, it just befuddles me. I don't think it has anything to do with the way the Iranian regime works.
Okay, let's go ahead and expand the conversation and bring in a caller. Sam is on the line from Nashville, Tennessee. Sam, what's on your mind?
This is kind of counterintuitive and probably may not make any sense, but is there any chance this is just sort of politically convenient for the hawks in the White House that actually this is another way of sort of declaring victory and going home, because it's just too politically difficult to actually solve the problem?
Flint, why don't you weigh in?
A few people have made that argument that in some way this is the way that Bush gets off the hook from mounting any kind of military campaign against Iran, but can blame it on the intelligence community. I don't believe for a minute that the administration engineered the conclusion of this estimate, and I say this as someone who thought that and still thinks that administration policy on this issue is very bad. But I think from the administration's point of view, this conclusion was actually very damaging for its Iran policy, for its broader credibility, and I don't believe for a second that the administration wanted the NIE to come out this way, much less tried to engineer it so it would come out this way.
Tim Weiner in New York, isn't there a lot conjecture, too, about when the administration might have learned about this report, or at least the formulation of its conclusions, how far back, and whether or not that affected Mr. Bush's comments when they were released?
Well, all this reminds me of a story that Lyndon Johnson used to tell about his feelings about the intelligence community. He said, when I was a kid in Texas, I used to have a cow, and I'd go out in the morning, milk that cow, get a nice, fresh pail of white milk, and then the cow would swing her manure-smeared tail right through that pail. He said, that's what those intelligence guys are like. You get a nice, good policy going, and they swing their tail through it. And, you know, the president and his circle had raised the alarm pretty loud on Iran, and now comes their intelligence community saying, you know what, don't even start planning to bomb Iranian nuclear weapons sites, because in our judgment there aren't any active ones right now. kind of messes up the target list.
Was President Bush responsible or irresponsible in his rhetoric? Has the administration hyped the threat, Tim?
Well, nobody likes to talk about World War III, or World War IV, for that matter. It makes people nervous when they hear presidents or policymakers or pundits raising that specter. The idea that at this stage of the game, with our army half exhausted in Iraq, our diplomacy at a pretty low ebb, and our intelligence community rebuilding from probably the worst series of disasters in its history earlier in this decade, that we would mount another war made a lot of people queasy.
Let's go back and listen to what President Bush had to say, giving a stern warning about Iran's intention back in October.
If Iran had a nuclear weapon, it would be a dangerous threat to world peace. We got a leader in Iran who has announced that he wants to destroy Israel. So I've told people that if you're interested in avoiding World War III, it seems like you ought to be interested in preventing them from having the knowledge necessary to make a nuclear weapon. And I take the threat of Iran with a nuclear weapon very seriously.
Rual, you're an Iran expert. What has been the Iranian reaction to the intelligence estimate? How might this report itself influence events on the ground there?
Well, I suspect what's going to happen on the Iranian side is they will continue to advance as quickly as they can. I actually don't think the Iranians have stalled all that much. They may have halted the no-alibi part of their militarization program, that is the construction of warheads. The other part of that program, the most important, the fuel cycle part, I mean, they've moved and moved, I think, with fair speed. An accomplishment. I mean, again, you have to view this program for them as being their Manhattan Project. They have done far better than I think many people thought was possible. The general Iranian reaction when the Natanz facility was revealed in 2002 was, and inside of Iran, is, oh my God, the clerical regime can do this, because the clerical regime has had a history of screwing up lots of different things inside the country and depressing the populace. And that they were able to do this so well, I think, surprised a lot of people. The thing to note on this NIE, it's very clear that if you come from an intelligence background, you lead the key judgments. It tells you quite clearly we have no active sources, series of sources, because you'd have to have that inside of the nuclear program. That what we had, assuming we had it, was a good moment of clarity coming from some type of intel dump. Some walk-in or combination of intelligence sources. Again, I'd like to look at it. I'm not going to be able to look at it, but I don't trust these things unless you get to see them firsthand. But certainly if you read the key judgments, and I'm sure the Iranians have read them closely, they have some familiarity with the American intelligence approach, modus operandi against them, considering how successfully they dismantled us on occasion. That they look at this and they say, oh, it's quite clear. They have no sources inside of our program. If that is the case, and I believe it is, they're going to actually feel fairly confident. And I suspect the Iranian reaction to this is full steam ahead.
Rual, how good, you talked about how good our intelligence is on the ground in Iran. Wasn't there a report that one of the reasons that Iran changed its mind or tried to change its mind regarding the estimate was that they had heard some generals, Iranian generals, complaining about the dismantling of how the they had heard that generals were grumbling about how the program had been canceled, and that was an indicator. Tim, is there any truth to that report? And maybe you can weigh in on how good our intelligence is on the ground and how it has been historically there.
Right. Rual is a former intelligence professional, obviously read between the lines quite correctly there. There was clearly a couple, not one, but two, possibly three, streams of reporting this summer that caused the CIA and the intelligence community to go, whoa, 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 we better look at this pretty hard because we think maybe they've stopped their program. Now, whether that came from Russian sources inside the civilian side of the nuclear program, or a defecting Iranian scientist, or electronic eavesdropping on griping Iranian generals. All of that has been reported. Some or all of that may be true. What's clear is that they had a stream of fresh reporting this summer that caused them to say, hold it, we have to reverse our estimate on the Iranian nuclear program. Admiral McConnell walked into the president sometime in August and said, Mr. President, we've got some new info. The president said, oh, really? Tell me when it's, you know, when the pie is baked, I'll give me a slice. And the pie finally got baked in November, and the key judgments declassified just a few weeks ago.
Flint, from your point of view, how good is our intelligence on the ground? And historically, has it been very good?
No, I think that this is one of the real problems when you don't maintain an embassy, you don't maintain any kind of official representation in a country where you have serious intelligence needs like Iran. You know, on the ground collection becomes extremely difficult. I think that there are serious problems in our coverage of Iran, the nuclear issue, and many other important questions about Iran.
You know, Richard Helms, James, the former director of Central Intelligence, used to say, we can build all the spy satellites we want, and we do. And we can build all the electronic eavesdropping stations we can, and we do. But at the end of the day, the only way to know what another person thinks is to talk to them, and that's the business of spies. It's also the business of diplomats.
That's right.
And because we don't have an embassy, everyone knows why. We were kicked out of the country and our people taken hostage in 1979 during the overthrow of the Shah and in the aftermath of the Shah of Iran. That we rely on secondhand sources here by and large. We had a network of Iranian spies that we rebuilt in the 80s, but due to a idiotic error of tradecraft at the CIA's Frankfurt station, they were all rolled up.
Are you not at all optimistic that some gains have been made in the more immediate time frame?
Well, Ken? You know, do we have boots on the ground there or slippers on the ground? Maybe. I'd be pleasantly surprised. We have relied for a long time on the kindness of so-called friendly foreign intelligence services.
And Ruel, very quickly, 30 seconds, what's your take on whether any progress is being made on the ground in Iran?
I doubt it. I mean, the type of operations we run, I don't think the methods have changed much since when I was in working on the Iranian target. You know, it's hit or miss. This type of intelligence, particularly anything dealing with nuclear intelligence, is really a game of walk-ins. It always is, no matter what the target. Certainly the harder the target, the more important it is that you have a lot of luck and you have many walk-ins that give you some confidence in what you're saying.
This is On Point. I'm James Hattori in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the politics of intelligence and the game-changing spy report on Iran. Joining me from New York is Tim Weiner, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for The New York Times. His new book, Legacy of Ashes, The History of the CIA, won the National Book Award just last month. From Washington, Flint Leverett, a former official with the CIA, State Department, and the National Security Council under President Bush. He's now a director at the New America Foundation. And from Prague, we have Ruel Marc Gerecht, a former CIA Middle East analyst and now a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Gentlemen, let's take another call. We have Sigid calling from Green Bay, Wisconsin. What's on your mind?
Hello, James. I think that our intelligence community has fallen prey to a very active disinformation campaign conducted by Iranian intelligence. A general by the name of Askari, who was serving as Undersecretary of Defense on a state visit to Syria, disappears in Turkey on his way back to Iran. It is widely speculated that American intelligence has him and that he was planted as part of this disinformation campaign. There also, as your guests say, the report proves that we have no significant independent sources inside Iran to be able to corroborate any of this. And furthermore, if you take a step back and just look at this from the standpoint of energy policy planners in Iran, and understand that Iran has more than 400 years of its domestic oil needs in known reserves. Yet it is dependent on the import of refined oil for more than 40% of its domestic use. So it has spent billions of dollars. It has exposed itself to significant international isolation and scrutiny, and perhaps even war, in order to create energy independence makes absolutely no sense. A expenditure of a fraction of that cost in adding refining capacity would have made Iran oil independent forevermore. Iran today exports about 2 million barrels a day. In 1978, it exported 6 million barrels a day. So again, a small fraction of what it has spent in pursuit of nuclear technology, spent in refining capacity, and spent on its oil infrastructure, would have resulted in substantial increases in its ability to export and its revenues. So economically, this makes no sense. On its surface, this report cannot be right, and I am afraid that American intelligence has fallen prey to this very significant disinformation campaign conducted by the Iranian intelligence.
Saeed, thank you very much. Flint, what about it? Is oil and economics more of a driver in this than we're acknowledging?
Look, I think that it's important to distinguish when, to a degree, what it is we're talking about when we talk about a nuclear weapons program. You know, the NIE draws a distinction between Iran's fuel cycle activities, its efforts to develop the capabilities in particular to enrich uranium, either for purposes of nuclear reactor fuel or potentially fissile material for use in a nuclear weapon. They distinguish that from other weapons-related kinds of activities, whether it's warhead design, whether it's working on polonium triggers, what have you. And I think that is, to a degree, that the NIE is being misread, because what the intelligence community is saying is that some of these purely weapons-related aspects of Iran's nuclear program, which they believe were going on, seem to have been suspended in 2003. That may or may not be correct. But the NIE says very clearly, and we of course know from the Iranians' own public statements from the IAEA and so forth, that they are continuing to work on their fuel cycle infrastructure, their capability to enrich uranium. Now, this in and of itself is not illegal, but it does present an important foreign policy and proliferation problem. And that, I think, is a distinction that is tending to get lost in the public discussion.
Let's take another caller, Sean from Worcester, Massachusetts. Hi, how are you today?
Hi, James. Thanks for taking my call. I was calling because I'm a student of theology, and I was thinking about some of the ways in which we read the Bible and try to reflect on whether something's likely to be historical, say, in the New Testament. And one of those ways is the principle of embarrassment. So if something seems like it might embarrass early church and it's in the Bible, it's more likely to be historical. And I'm wondering if that gives any credibility to this NIE that some of what's there might embarrass the administration, or also the multiple attestation that it comes from different sources. I wonder if your guests think that based on either of those criteria, it's more likely to be credible than our earlier NIE.
Ruel, what do you think?
No, I don't. I mean, I think the generation of the NIE at a working level is a thing unto itself. It's a very bureaucratic process. I think the analysts involved tend to follow what you might call the Washington zeitgeist, and that is whatever direction Washington as an establishment, the CIA in particular, which is still the leading organization and moving NIEs, is thinking, that tends to come out in an NIE. I mean, it's not at all surprising that you would find this NIE to go against somewhat its last one in 2005. I mean, what's disconcerting, it to go back to what Flint was talking about, is that if you look at paragraph one of the NIE, the way that thing was written was very inflammatory, you might say. It would have been far better for it to be placed further down in the NIE to take a footnote down there where they talk about what weaponization means and bring it up, put it in the text. It could have been a far less grandiloquent opening. And if it had been, I think the stir on this wouldn't have been so much. And I suspect that the folks who wrote the key judgment knew exactly what they were doing, and they wanted, in fact, to bring an attention to this. And I'm not sure that's because that the intelligence is necessarily embarrassing, but it's because they wanted to play a role in policy formulation.
Let me ask each of you to weigh in on this, what may be the bigger issue in all this, and that is to what extent politics is mixing in with the way intelligence is handled in the U.S. now. I mean, from the weapons of mass destruction debacle through this release of, this stunning release of an estimate now on Iran, do you think that it sort of heralds a different way of doing things with intelligence and how it affects U.S. policy going forward, Tim?
Well, in fact, there is a different way of doing things as compared to 5 years ago when the CIA and the intelligence community produced the Iraqi weapons of mass destruction estimate, and I think we're all happy that there have been some changes since that report proved to be a disaster for the United States and the wider world. The way in which this work has done has been changed. It is under new leadership, and the leadership is doing things a little differently. They are asking themselves, how do we know what we know? They are doing more stock-taking. They are re-examining old assumptions. They are scrutinizing old information in a different light. And I think those changes, which have been imposed quite recently, show up in this NIE, and they give me, and I should say I've read thousands of estimates over the years, as your other guests have, I'm sure, this gives me a bit of confidence that we may be headed back onto the trail of reliable intelligence analysis.
Ruel, what about you? Is this a good thing that there's more disclosure, more information coming out, and that it's in the public realm to debate and perhaps have an influence over U.S. policy?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I don't think the public discussion of intelligence in this way, which almost gives it sort of a conical authority, is terribly good. I don't think it's healthy for the intelligence community, which, after all, is just making its best guess. It's certainly not healthy for the political process, and I don't think either a Democratic president or a Republican president wants its policy, its foreign policy, dictated by an intelligence community. I have to say, I actually think, time will tell, but I suspect that the Iraq NIE, and this one has a lot in common, and that is that the intelligence community actually doesn't have a lot of information. And when it doesn't have a lot of information, a little bit of information, particularly a little bit of information that tends to glow a lot, has the capacity to distort judgment fairly quickly. And I think this is just, again, it's one of the difficulties that you have in the intelligence profession, is that on very difficult subjects, and certainly the Iranian nuclear program is one, you're not going to have a lot of good information. And it's going to be a very difficult program to penetrate. That's why probably if you look at it, the IAEA information is as good as any, that that when you do have such a small amount, the potential for distortion, for mistakes, for politicization goes up, not down.
Flint, what do you think? Is more politicization of intelligence reports and policy inevitable?
Well, look, I think that what we're seeing going on over the NIE is a response to a prior politicization of the intelligence process. I mean, in the end, intelligence agencies exist, and at least some of them exist, as separate entities apart from policymaking agencies, precisely so that they are positioned to tell uncomfortable things to policymakers. Now, that relationship, both in terms of the willingness of the intelligence community to speak uncomfortable truths, and the willingness of policymakers to let that happen, I think, broke down in a very serious way early in the Bush administration. And that is a very, very serious problem that the intelligence community and the policy process really hasn't recovered from. And, you know, I think you see now at this point the intelligence community trying to act in self-protective ways. You see the policy agencies trying to act in self-protective ways. And unless we can sort of restore a consensus about what intelligence is supposed to do, what intelligence officers' duties are, and that they are not being mutinous when they actually say something that they believe, even if it conflicts with policy. Until we can restore that kind of consensus, I think you're going to see, the system is not going to work the way it should, and you are going to see more displays of the kind that surrounded this this NIE.
Let's take another call. Peter is calling from Boston. How are you, Peter, and what's on your mind today?
Hey, James. Thanks for taking my call here. Over the last 12 months, it's been a pretty significant issue in Congress and the presidential nomination and from the White House about what to do about Iran. It's been kind of held by both the Republicans and the Democrats. What's sort of puzzling to me is how this discussion can be put on the table of whether or not to possibly take military action against Iran, even without specific evidence suggesting that they have weapons or potential to develop weapons, nuclear weapons. And sort of my view on this is that it's sort of beyond what we should be doing if we're making decisions without specific evidence to take military action, when we should really be learning from our lesson from Iraq, where we should have specific evidence before we can make a decision to put military action on the table. And that's sort of my problem with why this we haven't really responded correctly to this estimate.
Tim, what's your reaction? Has the Bush administration changed its tone a little bit regarding the possibility of military action?
I think they have, and I think that we Americans have all learned to our sorrow from the Iraq experience that taking military action without good intelligence is a fool's errand. I also think that everybody in the intelligence community who's worth a grain of salt knows what the rules of the road are. I mean, they're pretty basic. Tell them what you think. Tell them what you know. Tell them what you don't know. That's it. Keep those three separate. What do I know? What don't I know? What do I think? If you do that, you're a good reporter, whether you're a newspaper reporter or an intelligence analyst or an intelligence officer. If you start telling people what you think they want to know, you're a danger to the society.
Flint, do you harken back to the days when all this was done behind closed doors and people were made the best judgments they possibly could based on the information, perhaps in a little more professional way? And was it ever really isolated from politics, even back then?
Well, I'm not sure that it was ever done entirely behind closed doors. But I think that there has been a trend. It is certainly not unique to this administration, but I think it's been particularly intense under this administration, that unless the intelligence community or parts of the intelligence community were producing intelligence analysis that fit with the preconceptions of policymakers, that was the fault of the intelligence community, and it policymakers needed to find ways around that. And I think that really distorted this critical relationship between the intelligence community and policy world. And I think it's going to take us a while and some real leadership on both sides to restore that relationship to something more like it should be.
Ruel, how do you think our allies are reading all this unfolding in the U.S.? Is it comforting to them or is it alarming?
I'd say it's amusement and horror. Again, it certainly behooves the administration to ensure that the principal, the members of the EU3, the French, the British, and the, even the Germans, and the Israelis get to review in detail all of the primary material that was behind the NIE to see if they agree with it, to see if they disagree. And if they disagree, those judgments should go not through liaison channels only, but should go directly to the White House. You should absolutely have a debate about this issue amongst the intelligence community, the transatlantic intelligence community, and more importantly, the transatlantic political community.
Okay, Reuel, we have to leave it there, I'm afraid. We're running out of time. Tim Weiner, Flint Leverett, and Reuel Marc Gerecht, thank you for joining us for this program. You can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm James Satori for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.